Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a second horrific terrorist attack in the UK that has left 7 innocents dead and 48 wounded, and 3 terrorists shot dead by police, with 12 more suspects arrested. Nafees Ahmed, the editor-in-chief of Insurgents Intelligence at Medium.com and a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye, joins us from London to discuss his latest article at Insurgent Intelligence, The Manchester Bombing as Blowback, and the role of the British intelligence services in covertly supporting jihadist groups in Syria and Libya. We'll look into the handling of the 300 ISIS and al-Nusra jihadists who have returned to the UK after fighting in Syria and Iraq, and how this latest terrorist attack is likely to impact Thursday's election as the current Prime Minister Theresa May's lead in the polls continues to shrink, while she vows to clamp down after announcing that there has been, quote, too much tolerance of Islamic extremism in the UK. Since before becoming Prime Minister, she was Home Secretary. Theresa May is particularly vulnerable to the same criticism that she herself is levelling. Then we'll speak with Anders Aslan, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He served as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and was an economic advisor to the government of Russia, and joins us to discuss Jared Kushner's December meeting with the head of Russia's VEB Bank, that is both a private slush fund for Vladimir Putin and an asset of the Russian intelligence services. We will examine the Trump family and the Trump campaign's murky ties to Russian money, and who will emerge the winner from Trump's war with the U.S. intelligence community. Then finally, we will look into another stabbing that was not labeled as terrorism that took place recently in Portland, and speak with Daryl Johnson, the former head analyst for domestic terrorism at the United States Department of Homeland Security. He joins us to discuss the political resistance he experienced from Republican lawmakers who thwarted efforts to identify and combat the growth of white nationalist militias and terrorist groups inside the United States, which he wrote about in his book, Right-Wing Resurgence, How a Domestic Terrorist Threat is Being Ignored. And joining us now from the UK is Nafees Ahmed, who's a best-selling author, international security scholar, and investigative journalist. He's the editor-in-chief of Insurgent Intelligence at Medium.com and writes for Vice's science and technology magazine Motherboard, and is a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye. His new novel is Zero Point, and he has an article at Insurgent Intelligence, co-authored with Mark Curtis, The Manchester Bombing as Blowback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nafees Ahmed.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And obviously, there's been another horrible bombing, not as many casualties as the Manchester bombing, but still people were mowed down on London Bridge and stabbed in a nearby pub. And it's all rather horrible, and it's very close to the elections on Thursday, so it's having, a profound political impact. But let's start with the premise of your recent article at Insurgent Intelligence, Manchester Bombings as Blowback. We recall, of course, the blowback from the Afghanistan war, where people like bin Laden were financed by both the Saudis and the CIA, and we know what happened there in terms of blowback. What's the analogy there with blowback in Manchester?
Well, what we did with this briefing is we wanted to collate all of the kind of public record evidence that was emerging, mostly from mainstream media sources, a couple of other sources as well, WikiLeaks cables and other things, and really just build a picture of what happened. And what's emerged, really, and it's obviously it's a bitter irony that we published our briefing on the morning of the same day that this horrifying attack then unfolded in the streets of London, not very far from where I actually live, in the evening. But we put this briefing out really to change the national conversation a little bit, and to bring together all the evidence which shows that Salman Abadi, obviously the suicide bomber who was responsible for the Manchester attack, that he, his father, his family were very much embedded in the Libyan Islamic fighting group, which had been essentially co-opted by the British state in its efforts to basically topple Gaddafi. And this kind of whole agenda had actually gone back some years, but obviously kind of accelerated in 2011. And what our briefing shows is that what was very dangerous about this scenario was that the LIFG, which was an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group, it had gone through various permutations in its relationship with Al-Qaeda. At one point, it had even rejected Al-Qaeda. But the reality is, and this is what we document, is that they had established their, you know, whatever happened in terms of the leadership's kind of, you know, official relationship with Al-Qaeda, in terms of personnel, this group maintained very tight relationships with both Al-Qaeda and what was emerging to be ISIS, kind of from the remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And what we documented is that both British and American intelligence were actually aware from around 2006 onwards of how there were we had these Libyan fighters going and joining Al-Qaeda in Iraq, intersecting with people who would eventually go on to form ISIS, and then going back to Libya and wanting to topple Gaddafi. And these were the same people who were actually enrolled in their jihad against the Gaddafi regime, which obviously was supported by the United States and Britain and NATO overall. And what we also kind of homed in on is the evidence that British security services actually kind of green-lighted many Britons who were affiliated to these networks, who had established links with the LIFG over many years, and many also in Manchester, including the Arbery family, allowed them to basically, you know, go across to Libya. And they even lifted control orders on, which is a certain type of restrictive, it's a restrictive kind of code which is imposed on certain terrorism suspects. So they lifted these control orders on certain terrorist suspects to allow them to go. So there was a lot of this kind of stuff going on, which was very, very worrying. And what we now know is about, you know, there are about 850 Britons that traveled to Syria, to Libya, to other places about in the region in order to participate in this kind of, you know, in with various jihadist groups. And these about half of these people arrived back in Britain in around February. So we've got this situation where the British state has basically allied itself with terrorist groups. Specifically, we've allied ourselves with powerful countries like the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, which came up very, very much repeatedly in our briefing for financing very, very hardline Islamist jihadist groups. And specifically, we have cables showing, you know, kind of leaked cables showing that the intelligence community is actually very aware that both Saudi Arabia and Qatar have directly financed ISIS. We have this alarming partnership with these states which are funding ISIS, and we've got our own citizens who are going and intermingling with these groups and coming back, and we've got this kind of embarrassing situation where security services are embarrassed by this connection, don't want to admit it, they don't want to kind of have anyone kind of ask questions about it, so they're kind of allowing some of these people in without asking questions, and obviously it's increasing the kind of the opportunity for some of these people to kind of to become radicalized, to radicalize other people, to kind of go around freely spreading their ideas. And it really has inflated the danger of extremism in our society. And it really hits home. And Theresa May basically in her statement this morning said that there are people that there's too much tolerance of extremism in British society. And she's right. A lot of the tolerance of extremism that's going on is coming from the British state and its dubious partnerships with extremist states.
Now, my understanding is that there are some 300 returning jihadists who have fought for the Islamic State in both Syria and Iraq. So, how does that number compare? Do they commingle, if you will, with the Libyans? Because we know that the Manchester bomber was in Libya shortly before I think he came back 3 days before he blew himself up and killed all those people, mostly young kids he apparently, now we know that he got some training there. We don't quite know about how he had the skill to make that very complicated bomb that he made. But in general, is that what Theresa May is referring to when we're too tolerant? I don't know what the protocol is. I think here in the United States, if you came back having fought for ISIS in the Middle East, you'd go straight to jail.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, the problem is that we're not sure exactly what these people are doing when they've gone out to these countries. So obviously, the security services have been monitoring some of these people. They have an estimate of the number of people that have gone, come back, and what they're probably doing. They've got enough evidence, really, to be doing something at the borders, in my view, but they're not doing it. And I think that there are a number of issues here. I mean, let me address the issue, first of all, of what Theresa May was attempting to say when she talked about tolerance to extremism. She clearly wasn't really acknowledging any sort of kind of a failure or a lack of attention or any sort of kind of a policy issue in relation to what the British government has been doing. Her statement appeared to be saying, really, that there are pockets of problematic areas in our communities, and presumably, really, she didn't say it, but really she was kind of alluding to Muslim communities and suggesting that there are these pockets which are tolerating extremism, and that's really where the problem is, and something needs to be done, enough is enough. So, I mean, I think, of course, there are always going to be concerns about the way in which these people are able to operate in our communities, able to kind of harbor these ideas and not have them challenged, or not find kind of ways that they're being challenged. But the thing is that, you know, there's a question as to how much can really be done when you have such a large influx of people who are coming into our country, who've gone and fought with these various jihadist groups. I mean, some of them are ISIS, some of them are al-Nusra, and they're coming back, and nothing really is being done about them because of the security services' concerns over the embarrassment of their own role. And just to give you an example of how catastrophic this can be, apart from, of course, the catastrophe that has just taken place, but from the perspective of the security services, I mean, there was a trial that took place 2 years ago in London in the Old Bailey, where the Crown, the British government, attempted to prosecute a Swedish national by the name of Berlin Guido, who had who'd come back from Syria. He'd gone and fought with al-Nusra, at that time was a prescribed al-Qaeda affiliated group, he'd gone through traveling through London, so British authorities detained him. They wanted to prosecute him, and the trial collapsed because the defense basically highlighted the evidence that the British government had basically been supplying weapons and support, which had eventually ended up with al-Nusra, you know, which this guy had obviously fought with. And, you know, the security services didn't basically want to give evidence any further in that context, and the trial just literally collapsed as a result. So what you see from that example is that the British government is afraid to prosecute these people because of the reality that our government, Theresa May's government, has actually been involved in giving these people freedom of movement and, you know, supplying weapons to the groups, you know, or coordinating supplies, you know, with our allies of weapons to the groups that have been radicalizing these people. And I think that's really kind of the challenge that we're facing, is that, of course, the more needs to be done. When you see the horror of what's going on, I mean, we were just sitting at home, we were basically breaking our fast. Now, I'm a practicing Muslim, breaking my fast during Ramadan. We had some non-Muslim friends from my daughter's school come round visiting us. We were having breaking the fast together. It was a very, you know, enjoyable time. And then this thing breaks out on TV, and it's the sheer shock of this idea that people can literally just, in the most rudimentary fashion, coming out, mowing people down, stabbing people repeatedly in the street. I mean, it's absolutely shocking and horrifying. So something has to be done. And I will be the first person to say that Muslim communities should definitely do more. Anything we can do, we have to do it. And I would say that undoubtedly, if there are people harboring these ideas, then we do need to ask ourselves the question of of what more can we do in our mosques, in our schools, in our communities to ensure that people who come across these ideas realize that they are absolutely wrong. That there's no theological justification, that this is a twisted ideology, that there's no moral basis for this. So absolutely more needs to be done. But at the same time, we look to our government to protect us, and our government has shown that they are not capable of protecting us. In fact, what they have done over the last several years is create an intolerable situation where we've had three terrorist attacks in the space of 3 months, and it is not a coincidence that that has been on the back of multiple interventions from Iraq to Libya to Syria, where we have been involved in partnering with tyrannical regimes financing the very jihadists that we say that we are fighting. It doesn't make any sense. And so there is this question of blowback. The British state has a very, very urgent case to answer. In my view, there really needs to be an independent public inquiry, not just into the Manchester bombings, but really into the whole way in which the British government has approached its security policy over the last few years.
And, of course, Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, the elections are on Thursday. She's already, her lead has gone down considerably, and it perhaps will go down even further, because it's pretty hard for her not to take some responsibility for what you're talking about, because prior to becoming the Prime Minister, she was the Home Secretary. She had jurisdiction over all of these issues that you're talking about.
Absolutely. That's exactly the issue that is going to be on many people's minds. And obviously, Theresa May, she's said that she doesn't want this to be, you know, there's not going to be political campaigning today in the aftermath of the attacks, and the campaign will start tomorrow. But her response was a very political response, and it was basically about deflecting basically attention from the failures of the government. And instead, what she's done is she said, well, we need to talk about cyberspace. So she's literally saying we need to increase mass surveillance, we need to increase we need to decrease internet freedoms. You know, she criticizes technology companies again, which is, and the thing is, we've been through this literally a few months ago, and there were all sorts of questions that were raised about, well, you know, are the government's proposals really going to work? Are they going to mean anything? You know, she talked about increasing custodial sentences. She had all of the, and he talked about tolerance of extremism in our society, but none of the things he's spoken about would really be analyzed them. There's no evidence that they would mean anything in terms of preventing the series of attacks that we've seen this year in 2017. And the question really needs to be asked is, what is it that the government has done that has facilitated the ability of these people to carry out these kinds of attacks? On the one hand, we've had this ongoing kind of counter-extremism program, the PREVENT program, which has been criticized by people like myself and other academics and social sciences. Forget the politics around it. I mean, there is a very toxic politics about it, where some people are saying that, oh, it's a war on Islam, and they're criticizing certain types of Islam. And then you've got other people who are very supportive of it because they think we need something. And the reality is, of course, we need to have a robust counter-extremism program. The reality is, though, that the model that we currently have doesn't work, and the science behind it has been shown to be deeply flawed, because it's based on this very, very, very kind of like very sweeping ideas of how to kind of like try and assess the kind of the risk of somebody engaging in kind of extreme, kind of violent behavior as a result of extremist ideas. But the models that they're using, that, you know, there's no science behind them to show that these actually work. And what we're seeing from the evidence of the blowback type of kind of dimension that I've been talking about is that actually we have lots of evidence that there are specific groups of people who are particularly at risk, that for reasons that are inexplicable right now, our intelligence services are not picking them up. Salman Abedi was put on a terrorist watch list by the FBI. This is what we now know. And he was, the FBI informed MI5 and warned our security service and said, this guy is plotting an attack. Now, the question that needs to be asked is why, in that context, Abedi, nothing was done to raise the threat level about Abedi. He still had freedom of movement to come and go. This was a colossal failure. And no one is asking this question as to that colossal failure. And now, Theresa May, to be frank, has got the gall to be trying to deflect attention, say, well, you know, we're going to do all of this stuff. And really, this has happened under her watch. And the question we need to be asked is how has this government eroded our security through a series of domestic and international policies? And it's just not going to be good enough, really, to kind of say, well, we're just going to do all of these things. Because, you know, she's shown that she doesn't have the, she's lost that mandate, in my view.
Well, just in the last minute, when you mentioned toxic politics, Nafisa Ahmed, of course, nothing is more toxic than this disgusting, unqualified, reckless, incompetent, hateful, ill-informed president that we have here in the United States, Donald Trump, who, in response to the UK tragedy that we're talking about, he, of course, is going to use that to push for his Muslim ban. But Trump has attacked the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, again, clearly with veiled racism, not so veiled, actually. Trump is attacking Sadiq Khan for urging the British people not to be alarmed. And, of course, what Sadiq Khan said, not to be alarmed by the police presence. But this horrible president we have over here distorts it and makes it sound like Sadiq Khan is somehow pro-terrorist and telling the people not to be alarmed by this horrible incident. So God help us, I say.
Yeah, I mean, what can I say? It's a very unfortunate situation that we have. And it's inevitable that ISIS is basically, this is exactly what ISIS want. They want to basically create this cleavage inside our societies between Muslims and non-Muslims. And they want us to distrust each other and they want us to hate each other. And in that sense, Trump is doing exactly what ISIS want by pointing fingers at, you know, really Mayor Sadiq Khan is really his ally, his political ally. But what we're seeing here is that, you know, some of our political leaders are falling into exactly what ISIS wants us to do. And we have to be very, very careful that we don't go down that line.
Well, Nafisa Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nafisa Ahmed, who's a best-selling author, international security scholar, and investigative journalist. He's the editor-in-chief of Insurge Intelligence at Medium.com and writes for Vice's Science and Technology magazine, Motherboard, and is a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye. And his new novel is Zero Point, and he has an article at Insurge Intelligence, co-authored with Mark Curtis, The Manchester Bombings as Blowback. He joined us from London.
And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Jared Kushner's meeting with the KGB's banker.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anders Aslund, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences and worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And his books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslund.
Thank you.
And, of course, there's a lot of anticipation for the testimony coming up on Thursday, assuming it happens, with the former FBI director who Donald Trump fired. And, of course, there was a recent revelation about Jared Kushner that he was trying to set up a back channel
communications back channel, well, in fact, not a back channel, a covert channel with the Russians using Russian facilities, which is just mind-boggling. People are speculating about that quite energetically. But let's focus on what you have investigated since you spent 40 years studying the Russian economy and served there as a diplomat. I take it, in your opinion, and you've backed this up with a considerable amount of research, that the bank, that the banker that Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, met with in December, shortly after Trump was elected, the bank is essentially a slush fund for Vladimir Putin?
Indeed. Vnesh Ekonom Bank, it used to be the old Soviet Foreign Trade Bank, but it's ceased being so in 91. And in 2007, Putin, through a law, transformed the bank. So it became not a bank, but a non-governmental organization working for various state purposes, and transferred tens of billions of dollars to an NGO that he controls himself. Vnesh Ekonom Bank does not have a bank license. It has no published annual reports. It's not audited. It's a completely non-transparent organization. It does have a supervisory board and a management board, which are completely controlled by Vladimir Putin.
But it seems that, is this the way to look at Vlad? I mean, we know that Vladimir Putin and Medvedev, his prime minister, with whom he sort of swapped jobs, Navalny, the dissident who was recently injured, and has been harassed by the authorities. He made a video of the assets that Medvedev has squirreled away. But that's small potatoes, as far as we know. We hear that Vladimir Putin may have up to $80 billion squirreled away. But even if any of that's true, or even a fraction of that is true, it's not like these kleptocrats have all that money to spend on yachts and palaces. Isn't it also, when you talk about a slush fund, isn't it basically how they maintain political power through a system of patronage?
Indeed. So Vnesh Ekonom Bank was used to bail out the big state corporations and also the big oligarchy companies in 2008-2009 with $50 billion. Of state money that was transferred to the bank then from the government budget. And for the Winter Olympics in Sochi, in southern Russia in 2014, it was once again the Vnesh Ekonom Bank that financed it, but on that occasion, largely from its own balance sheet. And since that cost another $50 billion, that essentially brought the bank down, so that it got literally bankrupt and had to be bailed out by the government. And this is also how Putin operates. Rather than taking it straight from the government budget, he has taken money repeatedly from a sovereign wealth fund, the National Welfare Fund, which is supposed to be a rainy day fund. And Putin is using it for these shady purposes. So what we are seeing is that Putin operates with several effective slush funds that he controls himself without even the elementary control of the Russian state Duma, which is anyhow just a transmission band for his decisions.
And in terms of the intelligence connections to the VEB Bank, we know that Sergei Gorkov, the current head, graduated from the Academy of the Federal Security Services of Russia, but his predecessor, Vladimir Dmitriev, he was served as a diplomat in the Russian embassy in Stockholm and was expelled for espionage from Sweden in 1993. We also know that the VEB Bank has been used by the Russian intelligence services to give cover two spies, and a VEB employer, Yevgeny Buryakov, he was arrested in 2015 in the United States, sentenced to 30 months in prison. And of course, who was he trying to recruit? None other than Donald Trump's foreign affairs advisor, Carter Page. So, my God, there is so much smoke around this Russian story. I mean, it just keeps going on, and the drip keeps dripping. So, well, explain the role. We know it's a Putin slush fund, and so how does it operate in terms of Putin's former employer, the FSB?
Well, I think that Vanessa Econombank all along has been a KGB operation, as the foreign banks that the Soviet Union had. They had five foreign banks, were very much centers for espionage during the Cold War. And Vanessa Econombank continues functioning like this. And what I can't understand, that is why Vanessa Econombank, which is not a bank and which is not state-owned formally, well, that is allowed to have an office here after it was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury in July 2014, and after its number two representative here, Buryakov, has been sentenced for espionage. One would think that a natural decision would be to expel the VB office from the United States. And then in this, that Jared Kushner, in the middle of December, met the known senior intelligence officer, Sergei Gorkov, for a private meeting. It's just mind-boggling.
Let's turn back to the meeting that took place in December, shortly after Trump was elected, where his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who, I might add, has almost every portfolio in the Trump government. I mean, he's somebody that is not... He is a very key figure, shall we say, in this new administration. He, of course, bought his way. I mean, in a way, he's sort of following in his father-in-law's footsteps. His father, Charles Kushner, was sentenced to 14 months. He served 14 months of a two-year sentence for witness tampering and tax evasion. Charles Kushner, his brother-in-law had been cooperating with federal prosecutors, and so Charles Kushner hired a prostitute to seduce his own brother-in-law, and then he filmed this liaison and then posted the video to his sister, and they took it actually to law enforcement, and it backfired on him. So the father went to jail. The son ends up running the company. He decides that he wants to be a notice, just like Donald Trump, the boy from Queens, wanted to be noticed. And he bought the Observer, a newspaper, and then courted Trump's daughter, and to sort of, I suppose, in a way to show off, bought the most expensive piece of real estate in the history of Manhattan, 666 Fifth Avenue, just before the 2008 crash, and it's been underwater ever since, and they are sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul. So the great Kushner real estate empire is about as flim-flam as the great Trump real estate empire, wouldn't you say?
Indeed. I mean, this is probably what they were talking about. And interestingly, Jared Kushner has belittled the conversation he had with Gorkov and said that they didn't really talk about anything, while Sergei Gorkov has said that they talked about the Kushner family business, which directly implies that since Kushner at the time was seeking refinancing for this 666 Fifth Avenue, which cost him $1.8 billion in 2007. He needs refinancing for the big loans on that, and Gorkov presumably refers to that. But it might also be another thing. Trump has, the Trump Organization has got three different loans of a total of $400 million from Deutsche Bank. And since Trump's six bankruptcies in the early 1990s, the Trump Organization has been blacked out by the international banking world, and one single bank has given loans, Deutsche Bank. And there is a lot of speculation, particularly in the German newspapers, Die Zeit and Die Welt, that there might be Russian guarantees or Russian loans going to Deutsche Bank, because Deutsche Bank has recently been fined by the U.S. for $630 million for violating sanctions with regard to Russia. And Deutsche Bank is one of the banks that is most deeply involved in Russian government business. So therefore, it's particularly peculiar that Trump receives so much money from one single bank, which is deeply involved in Russia. So this is one thing that needs investigation. Another is that the Nesh Ekonom Bank provided $850 million in the purchase of the Ukrainian steelworks to Trump's partners in the Trump International Hotel in Toronto. Otherwise, that project would not have taken place. So there are here at least three big financial threats, all of them only suspicions, but it needs to be investigated how it actually hangs together.
Well, during the transition, we know that the Russian ambassador, Kislyak, who's also the top spy, the resident in the United States, he had this backdoor meeting at Trump Tower. You know, the pressure staked out the lobby. So there was no video of him. He snuck in the back door and he met with Michael Flynn, General Flynn, and Jared Kushner. And that's when, according to the Washington Post, there was a request, an extraordinary request from Jared Kushner to the Russian ambassador that he set up a covert communication channel between the Trump transition team and Moscow, presumably the Kremlin, using Russian diplomatic facilities. Now, the fact that our intelligence service was prepared to leak this information, because what was key to this information was that Kislyak himself was so puzzled by this peculiar offer that in his communications back to Moscow, he more or less said, you know, this is kind of crazy. So if our intelligence services are prepared to leak that vital information, which lets the Russians know that their most important communications have been intercepted, one would think that there are some people inside our intelligence community that find this whole thing alarming. So let's start with that premise. What do you make of that?
Well, we can see, for example, Admiral Michael Hayden, who has been head of both NSA and CIA, has come out viciously against Trump. And there are other of these former heads of CIA and NSA. And I think that these people reflect what people lower down in these organizations are saying, because they are highly respected in most organizations. So, indeed, I think that we are seeing that the intelligence community are simply saying this is not what we are supposed to do. We are supposed to serve the United States, the country, and not the president in his dubious business. But I'll tell you something about Ambassador Kislyak also. I know him reasonably well, and he is as Soviet as they come. Whenever he talks with anybody, he has a laundry list from the Russian Minister for Foreign Affairs. These are the 12 points that we want to push today. It is as predictable and as official as anything gets. He's speaking in a soft tone, but it's really like talking to radio that is only on transmission, and it is not receiving any feedback at all. if I talk to him, he reproaches me for various anti-Putin statements that I've said, and that he tells me that that is not correct. And he's not at all the charming type that the classical Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin was here, that charmed Henry Kissinger. Sergei Kislyak is very wooden indeed, and that makes it all the more surprising then that the Trump people are so fond of him.
Well, how do you understand what is going on at the broader level? And maybe we get a little more clarity from the former FBI director on Thursday, although perhaps people are anticipating too much from that hearing. Given how much Russia has become the centerpiece of both the investigations into Trump's election and his activities ever since, I guess the most charitable explanation would be that Trump was bailed out by Russian money, therefore, and he created connections to Russian oligarchs, some of whom might be connected to Putin, and therefore, because he knew nothing about foreign affairs or anything in terms of government, he has no military background, no government background, that was his only calling card, that as he said in the election, wouldn't it be great if we got along with Russia? Well, Russia's not that important. And the idea that you could make an anti-terrorism deal with Russia is absurd, because Russia has every reason in the world to want to combat terrorism. So they should be doing it on their own. They don't need America's cooperation. So the whole idea of Russia being the centerpiece of American foreign policy is very hard, very strange. So is it possible that they thought that you could just go from business dealings into political dealings? Are they that naive, or is there something more mendacious going on here?
I think it's something considerably worse that is going on. So what we do know is that Trump has received massive of private Russian funding for his real estate projects. And this is a matter of hundreds of millions of dollars of Russian individuals who have bought apartments in his various projects in New York and in Florida. What we also know is that several of these people are pretty odious criminals. What we don't know but can suspect is that much of the money has gone in ways that are not quite clean. So this is the commercial side of it. We have the strange Deutsche Bank financing of Trump's projects. But then we have what we have not discussed about here, the WikiLeaks links. And here we have two outstanding political operators, Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, who have been working for Trump, who have all the connections one can ask for with Russian WikiLeaks, in the case of Roger Stone, and Russia through Ukraine with regard to Paul Manafort. So that's where we would look for the collusion with Russia during the election. So this is another thread.
So at the end of the day, then, we can see how Trump has a firewall to some extent. He's got Devin Nunes, the CIA guy. He's got this incredibly inadequate guy as the director of national intelligence. But it does seem that the press is doing an extraordinarily good job, and one doesn't know how much the intelligence committees have been hobbled. The Senate seems to be doing more, obviously doing better, because they don't have Nunes in there sabotaging everything. But at the end of the day, how do you think this is ever going to break open? Obviously, there's expectations that it might break open on Thursday. I think that's too much to ask for, but do you feel at the end of the day, as you mentioned earlier, Anders Asland, that the people inside the intelligence community, they don't get paid a lot of money, but their motivation is essentially to serve the United States, and that is their identity and their honor, if you will. And from day one, Trump attacked their identity and their honor. and called them a bunch of Nazis and incompetents, etc. I think a lot of that came from Michael Flynn, who had this burning hatred of the CIA. But the long and the short of it is, it seems to me that at the end of the day, we've seen all this smoke, and I expect we're going to see some fire with all this smoke. What do you expect?
Yeah, I agree. But my suspicion is that we will see a continued drip, and of course one thing after the other that is coming through. These are big news items, and the two big intelligence agencies that Trump particularly has attacked, NSA, which is probably the very best since it's very so very technical. They have hard facts. And then CIA, which is more difficult since they are operating with all kinds of different facts. Sometimes they are not so accurate in their assessments. And NSA can be, but it's the biggest intelligence agency. So these two intelligence agencies are likely to fight Trump, since he has started fighting them, and they are not going to take it lying down. And we are then likely to see pieces as this that came out about Kushner, as you rightly pointed out. This is hard intelligence that is being leaked, and that really suggests that people in senior positions in intelligence agencies are prepared to do this.
Well, Anders Asselin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Anders Asselin, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences and worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And his books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Republican resistance to dealing with white nationalist domestic terrorism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Daryl Johnson, the owner of DT Analytics, a private consulting firm for law enforcement. He is the former lead analyst for domestic terrorism at the United States Department of Homeland Security and has over 25 years' experience working as a counterterrorism analyst for the U.S. government. He is the author of Right-Wing Resurgence, How a Domestic Terrorist Threat is Being Ignored. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daryl Johnson.
Thank you, Ian.
And Daryl, just to touch on earlier interviews about the latest terrorist attack in London, what do you make of the fact that Donald Trump has attacked London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, for his call to the people of London not to be alarmed by the deployment of police on the streets of London? Trump twisted that to say that the mayor of London is saying not to be alarmed by terrorism. And of course, he's using this tragedy to push for his Muslim ban. It seems to me that, you know, Muslims, whether in the UK or the United States, are our front line to deal with this problem of Islamic terrorism. They're the very people who can help us identify where the trouble lies and to prevent these kind of terrorist attacks.
Yeah, and they also are victims of white supremacy attacks on their places of worship as well as their homes. I think the mayor of London did the right thing, because if we give in to terrorism and we all stay in our homes and are fearful that we might become a victim of terrorist attacks, then the terrorists have succeeded. So we need to stand strong and unite and fight this type of threat and not be intimidated or scared.
And, of course, this attack in London involved the stabbing of a number of people, mostly tourists, near the London Bridge. But a few days ago here in the United States, we had a stabbing on a train in Portland, and it was carried out by an avowed white supremacist. I don't know whether he was a neo-Nazi, but it's hard to quite categorize that whole arena of right-wing extremism. But what's your sense then of in general, your background in the Department of Homeland Security as their former lead analyst on domestic terrorism? What happened to the branch of Homeland Security that is now defunct, the extremism and radicalization branch, and what was your relationship to that?
Yes, so I was the team lead for the domestic terrorism team. We studied non-Islamic terrorists, primarily white supremacists, sovereign citizens, militia extremists, and even some of the earth rights, animal rights, and anti-abortion extremists. So I led a team of analysts, and a report that I wrote in 2009 was leaked. It was meant for, you know, state and local law enforcement as kind of a warning that the threat landscape was changing with the election of the first black president, as well as the economy, housing bubble collapsing in 2008, that had become fertile recruitment ground and radicalization among the non-Islamic extremists that pretty much the presidential administrations and law enforcement weren't paying much attention to because we were so focused on Al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
So since then, have we been hobbled then because of this vacuum in identifying people like this character, Jeremy Christian, who stabbed three people, wounding one and killing two. And the people that he killed, as we know now, one was a veteran from Iraq with three children, and the other was looked like a really very sort of lovable, decent human being who was trying to protect a couple of young girls who were being harassed by this extremist.
Yeah, so what happened in the aftermath of my report being leaked is the Department of Homeland Security made a decision that they were not going to analyze this topic or produce any type of strategic intelligence assessments on these movements because of the political charged nature of these movements and the backlash to the report. So that left just the FBI as pretty much the chief federal government agency that's looking at this issue. They primarily look at it, you know, from a law enforcement perspective. They're not really looking at the radicalization aspects of it, the recruitment methods that they're using, the trends that are occurring over the throughout the country so that we can alert law enforcement to new tactics and tradecraft. The FBI primarily responds to when attack happens. They investigate it. They arrest people and prosecute. Their intelligence capabilities against these groups is very limited, and they don't really put out much useful information to the general public or to communities that are targeted by these groups.
And we know from the handling or the kid glove handling of the Oregon Wildlife Refuge standoff let me put it this way. It does seem that there's a double standard. We get hysterical about even the mere possibility of an Islamic connection to terrorism, whether real or imagined. But we're incredibly zealous in that regard, and obviously it's a huge problem. But on the other hand, we seem to be treating these domestic terrorists with kid gloves like the Bundys.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be mixed messages being sent out by, you know, government officials, whether they're legislators or in the executive branch or whether they're, you know, law enforcement. You know, we've had multiple incidents this year involving white nationalists killing people. In addition to the Portland stabbings, we had an African-American soldier killed at the University of Maryland College Park. He was also fatally stabbed on campus last month. We had the guy from Baltimore that traveled up to New York City, stabbed a black man there and wanted to incite a race war. We had members of the Aryan Strike Force being arrested in Pennsylvania on weapons and explosive offenses. We had the neo-Nazi down in Tampa just a week ago get arrested, had some bomb-making materials there. So there's been a whole host of activities this year. I'm just naming just a few off the top of my head. But we don't see any real government response. We don't see them, our government leaders calling these acts terrorism because they are ideologically motivated acts of violence against people meant to intimidate and instill fear in certain communities. So that's definitely lacking. You know, had this been a Muslim that attacked these people in Portland on the train there, I mean, national media would have covered it. Our national leaders would have came out and condemned it as a terrorist attack. But yet, you know, they basically turned a blind eye to these things and remain quiet. And so, you know, when you have people that don't call it out and don't condemn it in a manner that they should, it kind of emboldens these people that it's acceptable and that they can conduct another attack.
But just in the last couple of minutes, in the broader sense, so has Donald Trump emboldened this kind of activity from his campaign rhetoric in the 2016 election, at least to the extent to which he called on his supporters in these rallies to not only attack the press, but also, you know, kick him out, beat him up, this kind of incitement coming from the lips of the man who is now the president of the United States was at the time pretty disturbing. And we've seen this uptick in this kind of activity. And now the New York Times is just reporting that there's a group of right-wing, alt-right extremists who have formed a fight club. And their purpose is to go out to rallies or anti-Trump demonstrations and beat up liberals. That is their, you know, that's their bread political, and butter, for God's sake. I mean,
yeah, political candidates, people running for election, they need to understand that their words not only have meaning to those, you know, constituents that they're trying to reach out to, but it also have consequences. If your rhetoric gets too heated, it could agitate, you know, either fringe of the movement to actually act out and carry out acts of violence. The one thing that I'm amazed at, you know, as an analyst that's looked at this for, you know, 25 years, is how extremist ideas that I once looked at on white supremacist message boards, the idea of building a wall along the southern border to prevent, you know, immigrants from coming in, mass deportations of Mexicans out of the country, having travel bans, banning people for religious reasons. These were discussions that were on white supremacist message boards 10 years ago, and now they're being mainstreamed into the political debate. Well, that's kind of what the amazing change that has happened. And how much further are we going to get in our extremist and radical ideas during campaigns? It's like if you bring these ideas up now that once used to be on the outer fringes of the far right, now we're becoming accustomed to that. So what do you have to do to escalate it and to, you know, make it even more shocking?
Well, Darrell Johnson, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I really appreciate you joining us. And I'd like to do a follow-up. So again, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Darrell Johnson, the owner of DT Analytics, a private consulting firm for law enforcement. He's a former lead analyst for domestic terrorism at the United States Department of Homeland Security and has over 25 years' experience working as a counterterrorism analyst for the U.S. government. And he's the author of Right-Wing Resurgence, How a Domestic Terrorist Threat is Being Ignored. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.